Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today, we have a treat.
We have a treat.
We have several treats. Outstanding chefs, and there are three excellent cookbooks, and you get to listen to Charlie Fan.
Of the Slanted Door in San Francisco.
George Mendes.
Of Aldea in New York City.
And Johnny Iozzini, an outstanding pastry chef who's also very good looking and sexy.
Oh yeah, okay. Well, we didn't cover that one in the interview, but he snuck that one in my book. But I'm sure that's true. You're a person of very discriminating taste, so I'm sure that's absolutely true.
Yes. Charles Fan and the Slanted Door are legends in the restaurant industry. Charlie, we've known you for so many years. I remember all of these Slanted Door restaurants, including the one that had the little mezzanine on it, your first one. And looking back and thinking how long ago that was, you've been in business 25 years. Does it seem like that?
It's 20. I'm not quite 25.
Oh, 20 on that, yeah.
Yeah, I started in 1994. And opened the restaurant in 95. So, yeah, it's a lot of years for a restaurant. It's probably shorter than dog years.
Yes.
But this, the funny part about it is this story goes back to the Mekong River, right?
It goes back to, actually, Dalat. Dalat is a smaller town where I grew up. It was sort of like mountain, sort of Lake Tahoe or area with resort and cooler climate, so the French would have their resort. And I grew up with a little bit more French food exposure than probably most kids, just because where we live, and my mom had worked for a French hospital. And I was just always exposed to really good food, and just happened to like food a lot, very adventurous. I like to eat.
Well, you described your father as a serial entrepreneur, and in a way, you really are sort of an image of him and what led you to opening Slanted Door, right?
Yeah, he left China running away from the communists in the early 50s, and he tried a different career, you know, from doing ice cream cone to making beef jerky, and he didn't marry my mom until 61, so he basically was single and gypsy for about 10 years in Vietnam. Then I was born in 62, so he opened the store in 61, a little general store called the Wuhing General Store. And he always had an eye for business. I remember we moved to Chinatown, and he was a janitor, and he worked for an English pub, but he wanted to own his business. He can't stand for working for somebody. And Chinatown at that time was just kind of ends at Broadway Street. And the other side is where the Italians are, and the Italian meat market. But in between the Italian and the Chinatown was all the Broadway strip club and pornography store. And literally there was a pornography magazine store right on the corner. And back then it was like, oh my God, can't touch that. And it's so weird. But he said, no, we want that store. That store is going to go out. And he just sees that. And unfortunately, he didn't get the store, and the store went out of business within 6 months, you know. And he saw patterns. He see how things are good for location. The store we had in Vietnam was, like, the best. It was, like, somehow he knew there's a market, the new stairway down to the local wet market, and he built right on top of it. So he had to pass through his store to go to the market.
That's very clever. But now you had a very circuitous route to getting to owning a restaurant. I mean, you weren't formally trained as a chef or a restaurateur, were you?
No, I was not. I go to work at a young age at 15, start busing table at this English pub and nightclub in the 80s. I went to Berkeley, then I left Berkeley and came back, ran the family sewing shop. Then that went belly up. And then I went and sold software for a little while. But I had this idea in my head for 10 years, you know, before I opened. And I saw this kind of niche that no one was filling. I was more interested in architecture and the design. And I said, why can't you just have a really cool, hip, modern space with Vietnamese food? Because we would start missing Vietnamese food. Our parents are Chinese. We live in Chinatown, but there weren't any Vietnamese food, and Mom started making them. We realized how much more we, you know, I personally and my mom would miss Vietnamese food than Chinese food.
Uh-huh.
And I saw that niche, so I decided to open the restaurant, you know.
You
after
said your,
I,
your mom's spring rolls were like one of the big catalysts for doing this?
Well, you know, you don't have any cooking skill. You need, like, the secret weapon. And mom was making spring roll, and she had to figure out these recipes at these bus stops. And she had a sewing job, and she'd get off this union's job, sewing job, and there would be 20, 30 lady at the bus stop, and they'll trade cooking recipe, and that's why this recipe is a little different, because it's not typical of Vietnamese. They put sticky rice to bind it and make it creamy, and they had miso, which is a Japanese product, you know, because a long
that's
time ago Vietnam wouldn't have this stuff. But anyway, that gave me the confidence, like, this is going to be the signature dish, the star of the show, if you will. And so we opened the restaurant, but I kind of saw, like, how it was missing in the marketplace. Good noodle soup, a good pho shop, and also want to eat all the stuff with wine and with a little design. So that was all the impetus of opening it. So I had a clear vision of what I want to do, but I just don't know how to do it. And when I discovered Zuni and Chez Panisse, and you know, unfortunately, Judy Rogers has passed away.
Oh, I know. I feel bad about that.
Yeah, but I was at her memorial, and it makes me think back. It's because of her restaurant. It gave me the confidence, the open mind, because she only had like 6 or 10 things on her menu.
Right.
And when I was a kid working in a restaurant, there were like 20, 30 things, so you have to look like a
right.
real restaurant. And all of a sudden, this beautiful restaurant on Market Street that serves 6 or 10 things, and I was like, all right, I'm going to do the same. I'm going to have 6 things. And I couldn't even get 6 open on time, so I had to wait another 2 weeks to get the 6 on because I don't know how to cook.
I don't know what you did. It was magic, though. I mean, when I visited, that it was like a hole in the wall with a an illegal mezzanine, right? But the food was just knock your socks off. Now, how did you get that if you had no training or anything?
Well, since I didn't have training, so I just cooked, like, I would just buy, I didn't, like, figure out how to buy, like, a whole case of beans. I would buy, like, 2 pounds. I would think that somehow if I clean the bean once a day, it tastes better. I was just doing one thing at a time. I didn't know how to shortcut. And I just kind of, you know, with the architectural degree background, you just break the problem down little pieces. And you just fix it one at a time. And
well,
so,
then you hit the San Francisco dining scene like a typhoon. I mean, I still remember that. I mean, just out of nowhere.
It was actually considered a secret place.
Yeah, kind of.
When we went the first time, it was sort of, most people didn't even know about it.
I don't remember how we found it.
Somebody told us you should go to this place, and you won't believe you should go in when you get there. And I suspect I saw that look on your face. as we arrived at this address on Valencia Street.
You know, it's funny, I hear all these stories, and it's great to hear them now, but all I remember back in those days, like, I was always chasing my tail, and the curtain goes up at 5:30, and I'm running special and introducing the staff at 5 o'clock, and I was crazy. Like, I didn't have any formal, so I get inspired, and I would have dishes, and I'd bring food home by 10 o'clock, and then I would run a special by 5 o'clock, and they wouldn't even be on the menu. Maybe it gets in this computer system, and we would just verbal it. And I was just really just in the zone, and I don't remember anything. Cause once a customer come, I don't even have time to pee, let alone like talk to people. So,
but you seem to have some kind of a fate of good will and good works hovering over you, because you got thrown out of Valencia because of the mezzanine, I believe, if I recall correctly. But then you moved into that temporary space, which, I mean, I remember taking Lydia Bastianich there. The place with the big kitchen that you were in, that you rented, it was a temporary space. Do you know, is that the Brennan Street?
Yeah.
So, You know, I think part of the book, I always try to tell people and show, illustrate my story. Essentially, the other option is not very, there weren't a lot of good option for me. There weren't a lot of good option. My back against the wall. So, I mean, I was hoping this book would inspire other people. You know, sometimes you just gotta, you know, life, you know, one step at a time and do your best. And sometimes you just can't sit there and wait till the water drown you.
You just jumped in, didn't you? Yeah.
You just got to do it. And whatever solution I had was just completely really strange, you know. And who moves restaurant twice? But I didn't really have a choice. Couldn't stay where I was staying. I knew it was my staff. I had my staff, maybe my name. And back then, the internet weren't really big yet. And you just pray to God that someone will know that they've come. But you know what? I think the key is you have health and you have your belief, and you just do what you got to do. And sometimes you make it and sometimes you don't. And I had failure before. And I think the key is if you don't try, then you would not know. You give it all your best, and you give it all the shot at it.
Well, your current restaurant really essentially brought success to the Ferry Building. As I recall, there wasn't anything in it except for you and the farmer's market, right?
We're just the right place, the right time for the history of the city. Farmer's market was touch and go. They were going to stay. They're not going to go. They moved like 5 times. And I think that, I mean, 2 things that I'm grateful for is that, you know, if you really stay true to what you do and hopefully you have a product people like, you always keep your eye on the ball to make sure that the client, you know, the customer get the value. And I didn't know the Ferry Building. All I knew was when I tried on the second space, the check average went up. So I say, well, maybe it's just not right to have this kind of food back in the Mission anymore because I want to buy more expensive organic product. And you just kind of, through deductive reasoning, just, you know, you solve one problem at a time. And it's like, all right, I don't have a choice. I can't stay in Brennan Street. The deal fell through. Where do you go next? So I basically, you know, went all in, and it was just more than I could chew, more money than was triple the amount of money that we need. We thought we can go there for like $600,000 and went up, you know, like 1.6. And
it's a beautiful, beautiful restaurant. Gorgeous.
Yeah.
Your style comes through. I mean, your aesthetic and your style come through in the surroundings, which I think really helps a lot. But then you're also very, very picky about your ingredients, aren't you?
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to meet Ole Lundberg, and we become really close and like a perfect match for two of us. It was his first restaurant. It was my first design restaurant. And the ingredients has always been my hallmark. Like, I just, like, everything drives. A new dish would drive from the ingredient that I find. And when I do charity cooking, like I see in New York, and I might figure out somebody's scallop, and I will bring it back and apply my recipes. So my way of cooking has always been about ingredients and it's about culture. I don't like to mess with the original recipe, and I don't want to use the word authentic because it's all relative. It's just a time and place what I discovered in Vietnam, and I bring that back and I put my preference on things. And if I want a little bit more medium rare or a little harder, a little softer, and that's just, then it's a craft. But the ingredients always been my thing is that, and especially our cooking is so simple that if you don't have a good ingredients, you're not going to show through. But I also really believe in culture. I think you should bring a little piece of back so that if somebody don't like it, it just means that you don't like it. It doesn't mean it's wrong. You're actually more of someone who try to preserve a particular sensibility and time and place in, i.e. culture. So Vietnam will continue to change, and it will not be the same, you know, 20, 50 years from now. But it's really it's just a time stamp of what people like in Vietnam, you know, when I was a kid growing up, and bring those flavor back here. So people, and it gave me confidence, really. It's always gave me confidence to cook that way because I figure I just put it in there. There's nothing wrong with this dish. It's proven in Vietnam. They might like it. They might not. And some I win and probably have more win than losses. But I remember serving a sardine and clay pot, that dish on the cover of the book, and no one buy it one night. And I found out I sold 3, and I say, wait a minute, I comped 3. What happened? Like, we didn't sell a single one, you know,
So that didn't last on the menu, huh?
No, but it's down on the book cover.
It's a very beautiful dish.
Well, you said for us, you know, because when we interviewed you about your last book, it was home cooking. Now, the introduction here, these are all recipes from Slanted Door, right? This is this is the high end flagship of your restaurant empire. But the introduction says that we should all be able to make these things. Is that true?
Yeah, I really try to pick things that some are a little harder, obviously. So you just read through them. I don't know if you're not very good, so some of them might seem very hard for you. So I would encourage you to make sure you plan and have plan B, you know, maybe just make sure you have the phone number of a burrito joint nearby just in case you fail miserably. You're not going to have any food for tonight.
Well,
that's the only advice I can give you.
Now, the other thing you can do.
Or Chinese to go for that matter.
Yeah. Now, but hold on a second. You could also follow in another direction, which you also followed with a fascination with spirits, which is an extraordinarily non-Vietnamese thing to be interested
exactly.
in. Tell us about your pathway to Pepe Van Winkle.
I think, Peter, I beg the difference. I actually was introduced to cognac when I was 4 years old by my father.
Oh, wow.
The Vietnamese drank a lot of cognac because they couldn't get wine back then. So Dad will put a couple drops on my tongue, and I always love that. I never got enough to get drunk on, but it's a flavor, and I think it's just why I end up liking bourbon. And I was talking to you earlier that when we opened the bar, and Eric and Thad, to our staff, and Thad go on to open Bar Agricole, and Eric become my head guy here, we were very particular about the ingredients, who we buy from. So we had three bourbon, three gin, and lo and behold, we picked Pappy Van Winkle as our well bourbon, 12-year-old well bourbon.
That was 10 years ago.
Because back then, Pappy wasn't famous yet.
No.
It wasn't like $600 a bottle, so it was $20. So it was really good, and we knew what we were tasting, and you know, and we did not know how good it was, and we would have saved all that and make a big, you know, lots of money now. And Pappy was sold, and he cut me off 4 years ago, and that's when the popularity started to. The year he won the Spirit Award at the James Beer Award, I remember there, he and I with Frank Stitch and all the Southern Boy and John T. Etch and at Danny Meyer's restaurant, he bring out a little scope bottle out of his pocket, and we're drinking a maritage of bourbon at that party.
Uh-huh.
And that year I was nominated for Best Restaurant. I think Danny took the award. And Julian, Pappy Van Winkle's owner, the grandson, had to say, no, sorry, I can't give you any more bourbon. I sold my company.
Uh-huh.
And that's the year that we hadn't had the private barrel since. But then we found this little hole in the wall by where I park. And I, you know, me and Ole, my architect and best friend, we decided to open Heartwater. And it's been just... we're doing the same thing and just research on the food. Heartwater is like Pier 3, like 300 yards north of Ferry Building.
Okay.
But to give you, like, I was in Charleston, and I must have had, like, 20 different places, Hush Puppy. And that's how I do it. You know, I just go, and if I don't know something, I'm just going to go and eat as much as I can. And just to figure out what is really Hush Puppy. You can't learn it just from one guy. So you really need to eat everybody's Hush Puppy to get a sense of what are the landscape of Hush Puppy. And then you come back and you form your own opinion what Hush Puppy ought to be. Anyway, that's how we opened Heartwater with fried chicken and Hush Puppy.
Okay, so that's what that is. Now, is Out the Door still going?
Yeah, Out the Door. We did that. I bought a building and a little warehouse, ended up putting Out the Door underneath. And recently we got into a food service at a jazz club, and we're doing Oaxacan food, and now I partner with different chefs who are similar to philosophy. In fact, Remy, our chef, is from Zuni.
Yeah.
And we're doing Oaxacan because Judy passed away, Remy didn't stay, and it's just beautiful. And when you have great ingredient, and that's why a lot of time when you travel to Mexico and you have this perfect, granted that you're feeling pretty good when you're vacationing in Mexico, but the ingredient when they're just right on and the perfect simple cooking, you can't really beat those things.
Now, looking at this cookbook, which is beautiful. Now, you said you really weren't even interested in doing this cookbook because you don't like to brag, but you have a 2-book deal, so you did it. Right.
Yeah, and I'm glad I did it. And a lot of the little story, I forgot about it. I didn't recall. And like, I remember you read the section with Thad and Eric, how they come about our cocktail program. Bart Ellenbogen, a wine guy, and it just kind of, I think it's good for folks, for my family, especially, and see how Daddy got this done. But also, I think it's good for people from the outside and see how this little idea 20 years ago and how it become what it has become. It's just phenomenal. I don't think you could really see, this might not ever happen in other country, but it's just amazing. And I'm grateful that people still love this thing. We're still busy. We continue want to do the best we can.
Now, you say that there are certain recipes that have been on there from the very beginning that you wouldn't dare take off because there would be an uproar. Which are those?
Oh, definitely the spring roll, the shaking beef, and the crab cellophane noodle. Even though that over and over again, we constantly check them, sometimes we change the vendor of the beef. So even though they've been there for a long time, we make sure that it's just whatever we can tweak to make them better, we would.
I mean, I like that eggplant dish, the charred eggplant. Do you still have that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What are some of your favorite dishes, Charlie?
Of all the dishes, the kitchen, including myself, is the chicken noodle soup or the beef noodle soup, the pho. And it's just something, it's so simple, it's so clean that just we never get sick of eating it. And because we're around all the stuff all the time. So, and in trouble entree, crab and cellophane noodle is still my favorite.
That's good. That's wonderful.
But the noodle soup, it's by far all cross culture. It doesn't matter if you're Mexican or you're white, you're Chinese, that item, the staff can eat whatever they want from the restaurant, and that they eat that more than anything else, all across culture.
And like in the introduction, Danny Meyer says that there's as much San Francisco in your restaurant as there is Vietnamese food. You do view it as modernized. So what are the more modern dishes that you have that, because there's some in here I have not had.
Well, I think the modernization would be like we would maybe do the rack of lamb with lemongrass. What Danny meant by that is just our sensibility to the vegetable, to the sustainable farming. I'm 52 and I've been here since I was 13, so most of my life I spent in San Francisco. So it's only natural that I'm more San Franciscan than Vietnamese. And when Danny referred that, it's just really the way how our sensibility of buying vegetable, buying curing meat, buying food. And the chicken, like we use for the chicken noodle soup, is like come from this particular breed specifically for Chinatown. We're paying like $5.50, $6 a pound.
Oh, wow.
You know, far more. It takes like twice as long to grow than a Cornish cross. So it is that what he's referring to is that sensibility and the emphasis that we put on the ingredients that we use. And like the live diver scallop that with mint sauce, that's a little bit more modern. But again, we air freight, we pay a lot of money for that diver scallop because refuse to eat scallop with the TSB and the chemical, the treatment, that there's no point eating those.
That milky stuff, horrible.
Yeah.
Well, Charlie, this is a beautiful book. You have a beautiful restaurant with beautiful food. And you are a beautiful human being. It's good to talk to you again. There are, as I said, some recipes here, dishes that I haven't sampled. So that means we need to come back. And
hopefully
we can do that soon.
Yeah, we're overdue.
We are.
San Francisco is overdue and the Slender Door is overdue.
Yes. So, and after that, we can go to Hardwater and taste some bourbon.
Oh, good.
thank you for both you both for having me. It's a huge honor.
You know, I feel like you're a friend and somebody I admire so much, and I really wish you luck with this beautiful, beautiful cookbook.
Thank you.
We'll be back with George Mendez right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and next up, Orla George. Now, we've been trying to get this interview off the ground for a while now, but you're a very busy man, George Mendes. We fell in love with your food when you first opened Aldea in New York City. You have a couple more restaurants now, but that's still your flagship, right?
Well, I only have one. I only have two restaurants. One is Aldea, and the other one is Rupolo, which is being built right now. We're scheduled to open up in March of 2015.
Uh-huh. Does Aldea mean anything?
Aldea means village in Portuguese.
Okay, I thought there was something about that.
Right.
I even love the cover of your book. The book is titled, My Portugal. And Portugal is like one of our favorite places.
It's a marvelous place.
Yes, and you've been there and back quite a lot. But you grew up surrounded by Portuguese immigrants to Rhode Island, right?
Connecticut.
I mean Connecticut. I meant Connecticut. So, and what about your background is the same as Emeril Lagasse's, right?
Yeah, but believe me, I grew up to Portuguese immigrants. My folks got here in 1969. You know, I was born a few years later. I was submersed in the culture, and my mother cooking meals for the family, for my dad, my sister, and I. You know, we'd get home-cooked meals 6 to 7 days a week. The festivals, the holidays were just a feast of Portuguese traditional cooking.
Right. Now, I think people might be a little confused about what constitutes Portuguese traditional cooking, because what most people don't understand is the extent to which the Portuguese sailors covered the world and colonized all different parts of the world. And so, go ahead.
In the 15th century, it was the age of exploration for us. We were seafarers, discovering sea routes to many new lands and bringing back many spices into the European continent. That we were Portuguese responsible for that. A lot of trading, a lot of cinnamon, peppercorn, cloves, all that kind of stuff came into the European continent.
Chiles.
Yes.
Yeah. And what about piri-piri, which is also Portuguese now?
Right. Yeah, that's via Mozambique, via the African. African nations like Angola, where we've colonized in the past, and you know, where we're four Portuguese colonies. Excuse me.
There was this fascinating character called Prince Henry the Navigator. Am I on the right guy?
That's right.
But the thing that I remember about Portugal, which is more confusing and possibly not so interesting, unless you happen to be a geographer like I am, but I understand that the dictator of Portugal for many years, Salazar. Before he became the president, was actually the head of the Department of Geography at the University of Lisbon.
Yep.
So there's a tradition that continues to this day, I guess.
That's right.
But now, you have all those elements of your widely spread, widecast colonies imported into what would be viewed as traditional Portuguese cuisine. And you grew up surrounded, immersed by that. But then on top of it all, you traveled, you staged. Where all did you study?
You know, a lot of, the 90s, 94 was my first trip to Paris, working at Arpège with Alain Passard. And that was like my first introduction to real fine, both cuisine, or French cuisine. And, even back then, Mr. Passard was already cooking, and interpreting his family's recipes, his grandmother's cooking into his own, refined French manner. But he had many dishes that were named after his grandmother. He has grandmother's photo in the dining room. You know, that was my first little nudge to say, okay, don't forget your roots and don't forget where you came from and let your culture and where you came from influence the food that you cook. And that kind of, that was a little whisper that kind of stayed in the back of my mind as I kept my formal training. Came back to New York City and then went to Spain again in 2000, 2002, 2003, San Sebastian, and that was another period where it was, Martin Berastegui was cooking the recipes of his land, of the Basque region, and of his family. His family had opened up a little bodegon or a bistro of sorts that served traditional Basque cooking, and he was doing at his Basque, what he is doing at his three-star Michelin Basque restaurant today. Many of his dishes are interpretations from his family. So it was that kind of a thing that made me utilize my traditional classical French training and modern technique kind of combined. But then researching and reinterpreting old Portuguese recipes, and then also taking dishes that my mom would cook for us, like a tomato rice, and interpreting it in a refined manner, and the duck rice with the arroz de pato was also kind of born in the same way. It was taking my training and adapting it into traditional recipes and refining them.
Now, there are some unusual combinations in Portuguese cuisine. We came across them the first time because we have a good friend here in Pittsburgh, a restaurateur and chef called Tony Pies. And the first, I think almost the first time we went to the restaurant that he owned, he served pork and clams, which seems like an extraordinarily unusual combination.
Right. And do you know the history about that?
No. Go ahead.
The way that dish came about in the Alentejo region of Portugal, just south of Lisbon, beautiful land, very flat trees, a lot of fig and olive trees across very flat lands. Back years ago, a hundred years ago, there was a pork farmer who he had very limited grains and very limited feed supply for his pigs. And there was an influx of shellfish coming in from the south, from the southern waters, beyond the Algarve region, etc. So he had no choice, so he started feeding his pigs clams. And he was selling his pigs to restaurants, and they were cooking, the chefs and the restaurant owners were cooking the pigs from this farmer, and they're saying, you know, people keep telling us that your pigs taste like clams. So to cover it up, we're serving the pig with clams. And that's how that recipe was born, was from a farmer feeding his pigs clams, and the meat, the pig meat had a flavor of briny clam flavor to it. So the chef at a given restaurant to cover it up says, you know what, and if it tastes like clams, I'm going to serve it with clams. And that's how that dish was born.
Now, do you have any specials like that on your menu?
Oh, yeah, right now there's always an interpretation or a kind of nod to that combination of pork and clams. Right now we're doing suckling pig with clams in a sunchoke emulsion with pickled carrots. So
you have a section called The Search for Suckling Pig in your book.
Yes.
Do you want to tell us a little bit more about The Search for Suckling Pig?
Oh, sure. Well, the Baidada region, Portugal, which is kind of like stuck in this kind of pretty much the Douro region, is known for great suckling pigs. So what happened one afternoon is Genevieve Coe, my author, and I, we were in Porto, in the northern city of Porto, having lunch. So basically we made an afternoon turned into two different lunches, an early lunch and then a late lunch. We got pretty stuffed. We were in Porto, and we had to drive back into the city. I forgot what it was called at this point. This restaurant was very famous for their suckling pig. So we typed it into our GPS system in our phones to try to take us to this restaurant, and we ended up in this industrial city full of factories and car dealerships, and it just felt like you weren't in Portugal anymore. So we got kind of lost, and we ended up calling the restaurant, and they were closing at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was like 2:30, 2:45. We still couldn't find the restaurant, and then we're on the phone with them, and the owner says, okay, give us an idea of where you are right now. And we kind of neighborhood structures, where we were, the car dealership, the name, where we were. He's like, okay, well, you're down the road away, so we're going to send one of our property workers here. You're going to see a van with the emblem of the restaurant and a suckling pig picture on it, and you're just going to follow him, and he'll bring you to the restaurant. So sure enough, we waited patiently and appeared this van from the restaurant, and we just followed him to the restaurant, which is like another 10 or 15 minute drive from where we were, and that was our quest, our search to find the best suckling pig.
Yeah, no, we've had similar experiences.
Was it the best suckling pig?
It was pretty darn good, and they were so hospitable because we were the only diners in the restaurant at this point because they were closing and the staff was having their staff meal. But they had saved us a wonderful, beautiful spread portioned of pig and potatoes and a whole meal. And then after the meal, the owner and the chef took us on a tour of the restaurant because they were one of the only establishments in Portugal that actually receive live suckling pigs and then have been approved by the government and for slaughtering and butchering on site. So in came live suckling pigs, and they'd be processed, slaughtered, and butchered, and then put on the table that afternoon or the next day.
Wow. Well, are the regulations pretty strict there?
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
Is there any reason why?
It's kind of like the FDA is here. I mean, it's an establishment that goes and gets inspected and then certified, and you know the sanitary procedures are very, very, very important and very meticulously arranged and monitored.
You know, reading your cookbook, George, makes me so hungry. I mean, your recipes are so delicious, and
thank you.
Yeah, and the photography is also spectacular. I'm interested in your thought process. You've got all these elements, starting with your heritage, the Portuguese traditional foods, your experiences at these multi-star French iconic restaurants, your exposure in San Sebastian to more forward trending techniques, as well as your French classic training. Let's take a recipe and tell me how this all goes together. And the one I'm looking at is one I've been drooling over for a while, and it's called baby goat with beets, cinnamon, clove, yogurt, and charred bread emulsion.
Yeah.
How about your thought process there?
You know, the thought process itself, you know, baby goat is a very popular meat in Portugal, and it was something that I grew up eating as well. A lot of times it was whole roasted baby goat on a Sunday afternoon in the oven with potatoes. And that recipe came about after thinking, what are we, you know, we want to do something with day-old bread, which is very common in Portuguese cooking and culture. And I was inspired by a trip to Paris in 2010, I ate at my friend's restaurant in Paris called L'Astrance, and he served a grilled bread soup.
A minor restaurant, L'Astrance.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a three-star restaurant, and he served as an amuse-bouche, grilled bread soup, and it basically just tasted like liquid grilled bread, and it was amazing. It just, like, was mind-boggling that something so simple can taste so good. So when I came back to the U.S., and I started playing around with using bread as a main ingredient in a component on a dish. So the grilled bread puree came out of that inspiration. In Portugal, we utilize a lot of day-old bread for porridges and for migas, like crispy things, that little crispy breadcrumbs that you sprinkle over sardines, that kind of a thing. So with that dish with the goat, I wanted to serve day-old bread with it and focus, zoom in on this, charring the bread over charcoal and kind of burning it, pretty much, and then put it in the oven until it's dry. So it cannot be soft at all. It had to be as hard as a crouton. And then we would puree it in a blender with some dashi, utilizing a Japanese stock of bonito flakes and kombu seaweed to get that really zoom in on the umami qualities of it. So we pureed the bread with the dashi, and we got this really thick, unctuous flavor with a little bit of soy as well. And the result was this, like, kind of a haunting, almost like truffle-like aroma that we hit with the bread. And I called it poor man's truffle puree at one point. And it was, as the dish became, started to come together, we had the baby goat that was confit and pressed into a block, the skin on top that we could then crisp up. And then we wanted to add like an acidic, creamy note to it, because goat is very lean and can be very dry if you gotta be really careful how far you cook it. So I wanted to add some fat to it, a little bit of texture with acidity, and yogurt came into the picture for its mouthfeel and for its acidity as well from its fermentation. And on the bread puree, then we added some beets for sweetness, some red beets as well, and that's kind of how the dish came together.
I think we just recently interviewed a chef from Bar Tartine in San Francisco.
And yes.
One of her secret ingredients is burnt bread powdered.
Right.
Yeah, it's popular now. This, of course, so is toast. Now toast, and it has to be a little charred on the edges.
Only according to Mario Batali. And George Mendes, too.
Right.
George, you're particularly fond of soup. Could you explain that to us?
Soup in general to me is, I've always loved it. Again, I think it's not my mom is to blame, because we had soup at the house at least once a week of some kind, whether it was caldo verde, which is the collard green and chorizo.
Which I love, yeah.
Potato soup was very popular, especially for the holidays. We always eat it at midnight on Christmas Eve. Was very traditional. And my mother would always make either a chicken soup with orzo, or she would make this great cabbage and tomato soup many times, or there would be macaroni, or there would be some beans in there. So soup always had a big presence in the household, and it kind of carried over and influenced me as a chef as well.
Well, you're enraptured with your mother's tomato rice. I think I missed that. I don't understand. It doesn't turn me on like it does to you.
Oh, well, I think it's childhood memory. You know, I think I have very strong memories of cooking in the dam break, you know, they get home in the backyard over a small hibachi grill. My mother would grill sardines, and inside the kitchen inside, she would make a tomato rice, which is, it was very simple. We'd make a refugado or like a sofrito base of onions and garlic and smoked paprika and diced tomatoes, and you'd add rice to it and cook it with a chicken bouillon. So you'd make a nice tomato flavored rice. It was very simple, but there was something about the charred sardines and the grill that was served with this tomato rice, or sometimes it was just pork cutlets that were served with tomato rice. And it was just arroz de tomate, the Portuguese translation, is it's just a very popular, simple rice preparation all over Portugal. And my parents began to, my mom and my aunt and my mom were making it all the time in Connecticut. And that's kind of, you know, that's why I fell in love with it.
Now, we've gotten all this way through this interview. I can't believe we're 18 minutes into the interview and we haven't talked about Anne's favorite protein yet.
Which is?
Octopus.
Octopus. I get cravings for octopus like crazy.
Yeah.
Now, we were in Santiago de Compostela in October,
yeah.
And of course we got some good octopus there, but I suspect Portugal does even better octopus.
Especially in the Porto region.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so it's north. North. And almost in Spain, I guess.
Right.
Now, when my mother went to Portugal, she brought back a cookbook for me. And it was, the entire cookbook was bacalá.
Sure.
Just give us a little rundown. I mean, the joke is that there are about
65 preparations of bacalao throughout the entire year, every day of the year, that's right.
And that's a direct connection to the sailor's life, right?
Right, and the means of sustaining themselves when they were at sea for months on end, they learned the technique of preserving their catch, and it was salted. A lot of times it was preserved in seawater on the hulls of the ship, and then eventually the water would evaporate and it would just be preserved in salt. And that's how the bacalao was born, is it was basically dried in salt and held, and whenever the sailors needed to sustain themselves and nourish themselves and eat, they had this way of preserving fish, and they would boil it in seawater again to then ingest to eat it. Or sometimes I read stories also they would just break it off, dried, salted cod, as like a jerky of sorts, and that's how they would eat.
Well, you point out something that I learned. I grew up with just bacalá, but the when we were in Portugal in the one of the markets, we realized there's more to it than that. You could get, and you noted that you have a much superior way of salting your cod. There, you can get it dried and salted. You could get it mildly salted. What are the different types of bacalao you could get?
Well, many times you buy it dried and salted, where then you need to hydrate it and change it with water three times. You can get it also where it's already been soaked and rid of its salt before you're ready, where it's ready to cook. But most of the time it's packaged where you need to buy it and then soak it for consecutive days, change in the water.
Well, you do it yourself.
You can buy, you know, you can buy the thicker loin part, the belly, the tail, the collar, that kind of situation for different preparations.
But you do it in-house.
Yeah, we've chosen to, I was so enamored and obsessed with the product that I decided to do it myself from scratch. But it really comes down to just patience and letting it cure in salt for 3 days at least, or, you know, we've done it up to a week. We just let it hang and dry with salt on it, and then we'll hydrate it when we need it. You know, it becomes hard as a plank or hard as wood. But the beautiful thing about it is cod is a naturally mild, flaky white fish that doesn't have much flavor. It's very mild, and the salt gives it a flavor and really pushes forward and extracts the natural oceanic qualities of it, especially the skin, and kind of turns it into a steak and gives it a lot of texture.
Now, one other thing is I heard a story from someone. It was a magazine article, I think, in search of a particular dessert. Now, I never knew, but the Portuguese kitchen is very big on sweets. And,
yes.
And a lot of them
egg
came out of convents.
Yeah, very big on egg-based sweets.
And you have a section of desserts in your book, too.
That's
is
right.
The famous one that I'm trying to think of that was made in a convent? And I seem to think of meringues and something about a nun's tits. Do you know?
Not sure.
What is it?
They're associated with a place, with an area in the city of Lisbon called Belém, I think.
Oh, the pastéis de nata, yes.
Oh,
we make it here at the restaurant ourselves. It's a Portuguese egg custard tart.
Got
oh,
it,
okay.
Right.
All right.
So we have a recipe for them in the book as
it's
well.
It's in the book. Okay, George, now am I going to be able to make dishes as good at Aldi as Aldi following your recipes?
Yeah. You absolutely can. You absolutely can.
Well, I think it's a wonderful book, and I'm glad we finally pinned you down for some time to talk about it.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Again, it's George Mendes, and the book is called My Portugal. And I think you'll find, everybody will find it very stimulating. As I said, I drool as I'm reading it. And good luck on your new venture, too.
Yeah,
thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I hope we can welcome you there.
George, is there a website up for the new place?
Yeah, it's Lupulo NYC. It's under construction, but there is a home page for it right now.
Can you spell it out?
LUPULONYC.com.
Great. Well, I'm sure you probably have things to do associated with that, so let us let you go.
We do, indeed. Thank you so much.
Thanks, George. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And now we come to the third of our amazing trio today. We had nicely portioned out here Charlie, George, and now Johnny.
There you go. So, what did we say? What did Edmund Vaughn say? Here's Johnny. That was really terrible, wasn't it?
Yes.
But just in case you're wondering, dessert comes at the end, and this man knows his desserts.
One of my favorite pastry chefs, Johnny Uzzini, and also probably one of the best-looking pastry chefs I know. Hi, Johnny. Well, congratulations on your new book here.
Yeah. Thank you very much. That's very sweet. That's like probably the best introduction I've ever got.
That's true.
I feel like I got to write you a check for that one.
Your book is called Sugar Rush. Actually, the emphasis is on the rush, Sugar Rush. Sugar Rush.
Yeah, I mean,
subtitled. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
This is subtitled Master Tips, Techniques, and Recipes for Sweet Baking. And before we were chatting a little, before we started recording, I said it's really very different from your first book because we interviewed you for that book, and it was called Dessert Foreplay, right?
Indeed, indeed.
And it was, well, you described the difference. It was a totally different book from Sugar Rush.
Yeah, Dessert Foreplay, essentially, I was a pastry chef at the famed restaurant Jean Georges for a decade, which is a four-star, a New York Times, three-star Michelin restaurant. And that book was kind of a snapshot of what a year of tastings would look like, spreading it out through the four seasons and really highlighting different ingredients and techniques. And it's definitely something that was maybe a little bit more advanced for the home cook, whereas Sugar Rush is really geared towards people at home, people that are baking at home, people that are really interested in learning more about baking and the reasons why we bake the way we do or the techniques that we use. And there's a tons and tons of photos, lots of how-to, and very approachable. You know, the whole idea behind the book was we weren't going to use a single ingredient or a single piece of equipment that wasn't available in an everyday household coast to coast. So if you couldn't find it in your, we had a fictitious person named Margie from the Midwest. If Margie didn't have that ingredient at her local Stop and Shop or didn't already have that piece of equipment in her kitchen, then we wouldn't use it.
Well,
we built the whole book around that thing that we wanted to make it a book for everybody.
Well, but you're kind of a natural teacher because, I mean, I learned things reading this book, and I've been sort of around food for quite a long time. But you work it into, you're not didactic, you're not teachy. You just sort of work it in there, and you yourself have such a clear idea of where you want people to go that it's a natural that you pick up all this information and tips.
Yeah, and you know, I don't kid myself either. I know what I'm good at and I know what I'm not good at. So I brought on someone who I've been friends with for a very long time named Wes Martin. And Wes worked for Rachel Ray. He worked for Martha Stewart. And Wes is very good at translating ideas and recipes and getting them written very clearly. So, again, Margie will understand, you know, as a professional chef, the problem is so often we take so much for granted because
yes.
It's what we do every day. So we don't think about all the little steps. So when we started writing these recipes, Wes would stand right next to me, and he's like, why are you doing that? What are you doing that? What are you doing that? And I was like, what do you mean? And he really he really caught all these in-between steps that I never would have thought to write down. And it's really, you know, I owe him a ton of credit for really making this book flow and so understandable that anybody with the most minimal amount of experience could pick up a recipe and complete it and be successful.
Well, you just spell it out. I don't know how you could miss, really. Tell me about how you divided this up. You have your own idea of what these building blocks are, right?
Well, I think if you think about what the building blocks of pastry, like what do you learn? One of the first things I learned as a young, you know, I started taking culinary classes when I was in high school. I was lucky enough to go to a vocational school that offered regular studies half the day, and half the day I could start taking culinary classes. So at 15 and 16 years old, I was already enrolled in culinary classes. And I remember one of the first things I learned was how to make a vanilla sauce, a vanilla anglaise. What's a custard? What's all the different types of a custard? So I think just understanding the differences and things like that, that, again, if you're an advanced cook, you take it for granted. But the whole idea is that let's not take anything for granted. Let's even talk about butter out of the fridge. We've been taught, take butter out of the fridge before you make a recipe. Well, back in the day when your grandmother or somebody was making a dough, sure, they would take the butter out of the fridge to make it easier for themselves. They weren't using 675-watt KitchenAid mixers, right?
Right.
So the whole idea is, like, understanding why we did certain things. So I teach the opposite. I say, well, don't take – if you're going to put your butter in a strong machine and put it on paddle and cream it, you don't need to take it out of the fridge because, in the end, butter is an emulsion of fat and water, and it can break
if
you over-agitate or if you overheat it. So – if you're going to cream something, start it from cold, toss it in the sugar, and let's bring it up slowly. Have your eggs at room temperature because that's eventually where your butter is going to be, and that's really where the problems arise if you have a warm butter and cold eggs. But if you start with a warm butter and then you cream the crap out of it, incorporate a ton of air, break the emulsion, starting, you know, that's how you end up with a greasy product. So it's all about understanding why we do the things we do, you know. So often we do them because someone told us to do them that way, not because we understand why.
Yeah, you
do
that throughout the book. You tell why.
Yeah.
I never knew this whole thing about meringue. First of all, I never knew there were three different kinds of meringue, and I didn't understand the physics of whipping the egg whites. And you spell that out. I mean, how to get a strong bond for your a structure for your meringue, and I think I was really impressed with that whole thing on meringue, by the way.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like people always, you know, the whole idea is like, okay, identify a meringue. What is a meringue? What are the ingredients? What are the different types to make, you know, different types of meringues you can make? And then what are the different applications for each meringue? Really telling people and defining, okay, if you want to do this, this is the meringue you should use. This is how you make it and why. That's very important, understanding, again, why we do the things we do in the kitchen. And a lot of that comes from, A, my education and my experience for 20-something years, but also because I have great relations with people like Harold McGee, who wrote the amazing book on food and cooking. So much of it is referenced because I've researched because of great people like Harold, explains proteins unraveling, what an acid does, why we add cream of tartar or lemon juice or salt to a meringue, what it does, you know, how it helps us unravel these protein strands and then incorporate air into them. So we've taken the time to kind of learn these from all these people and then simplify it to a way that it makes sense for people at home without boring them with science.
So in other words, you sort of knew, you learned from people who told you that you should do this or you shouldn't do that, but then Harold helped you to understand why.
Exactly. So the whole idea of the book was to take 25 years of experience and pack it in a book, but make it so it's not, I'm not talking down to anybody, I'm not demeaning anybody, I'm not scaring anybody, and I didn't want it to be a textbook. So it's hopefully teaching you in a friendly manner that kind of it's inviting, and it's like, hey, you can do this. Trust me, I'll hold your hand. Follow the recipe. We've done tons of photos of step by step. So you look inside your mixer, and guess what? It's probably going to look just like mine does in the photo. The worst thing is most people won't make a recipe if they can't visualize it, right?
Yeah.
So especially me, I'm one of those people. Like coming up, I would always try to make recipes, but I had to see what they're supposed to look like, or something along the way is a reference point. So we try to give as many reference points as possible so people can really feel confident going through the recipe like they're doing it correctly.
I was really intrigued by the section on caramel. And you're just so careful in explaining how things should be. I mean, I feel safe. Whereas if I set off without your instruction, trying to heat up sugar so it would get to be caramelly, I'd be really frightened.
Yeah, you know, and hopefully I'm glad to hear that. You know, like I said, Wes is incredible at translating what I was trying to say and into words that would make sense for everyday people. So often kitchen speak just doesn't translate. So for me to say, go to camera, he's like, well, what does that mean? What color is that? What's happening with the bubbles? All the things that I take for granted, we spelled it out.
The color of the bubbles and the caramel, I thought that was amazing. It never occurred to me to look.
The color of the smoke that comes off, you know, when you're at about 172 degrees, the color of the smoke is almost whitish-bluish, you know, which is a great marker as well.
Well, you have so many helpers in here. You have these little stamps with stars, and some of them are mother recipes, and others are master techniques. How did you structure that?
Well, the mother recipe, the idea is that it's a base recipe. It's something that's always a reference point. So it's like the vanilla sauce, a vanilla anglaise, or a basic creme brulee. And then we get into master techniques, which, again, is elaborating on that, whether it's through adding steps and making it a bit more complicated, or it's adding flavor profiles, or it's taking it to the next level. You know, a great mentor of mine who I worked with for a long time was Jean George, and he has an amazing book called Simple to Spectacular. Essentially that. He builds upon basic techniques and just turns them something else. So that was always in the back of my mind that I thought that was such an amazing book that I wanted to kind of pay homage to that in a way, but also apply some of that to what we were trying to do. So, again, the more proficient you are, the farther you can take a recipe.
Right. Well, one of the really great things about this book is you take which on the surface are rather basic, ordinary recipes, and you give them a little tweak, and suddenly they're spectacular. I don't think any of us would come up with that on our own.
Well, that's the thing. You know, it's like I try to combine, again, all my years working for someone like Danielle Belloud or Jean George, who bring a world experience as I've learned so much from. So it's about me trying to trickle a little bit of my experience into that book and saying, hey, let me show you how to think out of the box. And maybe just adding a different spice than you would think of, or a combination of flavors that normally wouldn't make sense to you. So it's me saying, hey, let me show you how to think a little bit differently without forcing it down your throat.
Now, I still want to know how this lady in the subway gets 3 foot long churros.
You know what? It amazes me, and I see different women do it, and I keep asking them, and they
won't tell you.
I don't know what the deal is. I have a feeling, you know, I have a feeling I know how they do it at this point, where they think they're using those giant like Swiss braisers. They're like 3 feet long, and I think they just fill it with oil and create like a fryer, and they're just doing it in these giant vats, and that's the only way it makes sense to me. Unless they have an extruding machine, and but I don't think they're doing it commercially. I think they're doing it like renting a commercial kitchen and just banging them out.
What?
But one day I'm going to make friends with one of these guys, and they're going to tell me. They're going to give it up.
You cover the stuff that everybody's going to want to know how to make in here. I've never seen so many recipes for marshmallows in my whole life.
Yeah, and my style of marshmallow is very different than what you see normally if you were to say Google a marshmallow recipe. A lot of times people just will, they're like the Jet Puff kind, where it's like a corn syrup that's whipped and gelatin's added.
Yeah.
Mine is much fresher. It's something that I would serve al menu. It's something we actually served at Jean George. It's Italian meringue based with gelatin. And people are surprised because we cook the sugar so hot, cook it to 155 degrees Celsius. And then the gelatin goes directly into the hot sugar, which goes into the meringue, and it's all tricky. But it yields the most luxurious marshmallow you'll ever eat in your life. When we teach people, like, well, it doesn't have to be vanilla. There's amazing products on the shelf now, like freeze-dried fruit, that if you grind them up, you have freeze-dried powder. And freeze-dried powder is great to fold into a lot of different things to give you a pop of flavor.
I was surprised you included this. I'd call it a coffee cake. You call it a crumb cake. What is spectacular about it?
There's a fine line between a coffee cake and a crumb cake. I think a traditional coffee cake, they take some of the mixture out, or they make a separate mixture, and they fold in a chocolate mixture and swirl it through.
Yeah.
And that's technically a coffee cake, and this is technically a crumb cake, but yeah.
Yeah, a friend of mine's mother used to make it every week. She was German, and I have a recipe for it. But I liked it, but I didn't think it was anything spectacular. So I was surprised you included it.
Have you made mine?
No.
Yeah. So that recipe actually comes from back in my days of Danielle. I had a bunch of amazing people that would come and just to spend time in their own time with me. So one of these women, her name was Martha, she was a housewife, a homemaker. Every Saturday she would take the train in from Westchester and spend every Saturday with me. And she would bake during the week, so every Saturday she would bring me this cake. And it's one of the things I grew up with. My dad loves crumb cake. I love crumb cake. So, and then when it came time to do this book, I called her. I was like, I love your thing. I said, would you mind sharing the recipe with me, and you know, I want to adapt it a little bit for, tweak it a little bit for my preference, but, and so it was a way for me to play homage to her. But since then, she's like, sends me email. She's like, as long as you promise to never make it for yourself and just let me know when you want one,
oh,
and I'll make it and bake it. Send it to you. So every holiday, a box shows up at my door with crumb cake in it,
oh,
for
wonderful,
me and my family. She's,
oh,
amazing.
Wow. Now, this is an example of what I was talking about before, how you take some ordinary thing that we all kind of take for granted and you somehow elevate it. Could you just demonstrate that with the transformation you gave from a carrot cake recipe into a root cake?
Yeah, so again, and so much of what is in this book is stuff that I've learned from not only from chefs I work for, but from cooks I work for. So that recipe is actually based off an amazing recipe I learned from one of my former cooks, who is now the pastry chef at 11 Madison Park. She's Brazilian, and what she did, her name was Renata, it's actually a Brazilian, like a home-style cake that they would make in a blender with carrots. So we adapted it with parsnips and everything else. As usual, I have to complicate things, but I really thought it would be amazing by having all these amazing root flavors and the anise flavor and the glaze and everything else, and it's for me, it's one of my favorite recipes in the book, and it's very different. If I told somebody, like my dad, he doesn't eat parsnips, but I made him this cake and didn't tell him. He's like, oh, I love this cake. What's in it? I told parsnips. He's like, no way. You know, so it's one of those things that...
Well, the other thing, I think people will be really surprised to encounter your version of caramel corn.
Yeah. Well, I wanted... See, that's the other thing about this is, like, I said, okay, well, if I'm going to do a book that's essentially a lot of recipes that people are familiar with or may have a couple different recipes in their own arsenal of, it's got to be different, right? I didn't want to put out another Betty Crocker book, so it still had to maintain not only my pedigree to show, like, okay, well, here's why I'm different from everybody else, but it also had to have a certain masculinity to it. So if you see the photos, there's a lot of leather in the book. There's a lot of stone in the book and like rusted gears and the way I plated everything, still very approachable and homey, but there's still an edge to it, and that's still, like, I still bake that way, and I still cook that way, and I still think that way when I create recipes. So I really needed the book to still have a lot of my, I would say, culinary attitude. So that recipe, the cracked corn fat and rendered crispy bacon is part of it, so it's a very masculine version of a Cracker Jacks.
Right. One issue I have to pick with you is your pavlova. It's not right.
Oh, why? What don't you like about the pavlova?
You got to make it where it's an oval and it has to dome up and then sink down. You got to get the crackling on it. You know, we lived in Australia, and it's... Mm-hmm. My pavlova worked fine in Australia. I've never got it to work in the United States.
I spent some time in Australia as well, and I learned the way they make it, and in New Zealand they even make it a little bit differently than they do in Australia.
Yeah.
But for me, what a pavlova is, if you boil it down, is you have crispy meringue, you have fresh cream, and you have fruit. So it's a matter of understanding and ratio. And if stuff sits too long, you want there to be some moisture going into the meringue, so it's a little bit chewy, but you still have to maintain some of the crispiness. And so it's one of those things that, you know, I'm going to adapt it. And by no means do I say I'm the authority and this is the only way to make something. Everything is my version of learned it, the classics, and this is my interpretation. So
well, in our house, you serve it with a steak knife.
That's terrible.
There you go.
I'm looking here to talk to our listeners. What is this? Johnny was here in the back of the book.
So, you know, I'm a big prankster, and like, I think I would hope to think that one of the things, positive things that people would say about me is that I take what I do very seriously, but I don't take myself very seriously. I love to joke around. I love to prank. I'm always messing around, and I like a positive. Like I learned to cook in a very militant atmosphere where you were scared every day of making a mistake and this and that. And I tried not to be that way as a chef. And so in my kitchens, we've always had music on and everything else. You know, we're going to work 12, 15 hours a day, and it's very serious about what we do. And it's not by any means, there is no room for error, but at the same time, like, I want people to love what they do and love coming to work. That's just me, like, you know, we would have long shoot days, you know, again, 14-hour day shoot days, and sometimes I'd be doing something and I'd screw around on the table and it's just flour. there's so many outtakes and funny pictures from that shoot that never made it in the book, but...
Yeah, food shoots are awful.
Did you see the video?
Did what?
There's a. If you go on my website, you could watch the making of the Sugar Rush. We shot the whole behind the scenes of it.
Okay.
And there's some really funny stuff that goes on, including like there's a jelly bean game that's out there. They sell it in the stores, and it's essentially for every color there's like 5 or 10 colors of jelly beans. For every color, there's 2 flavors. So the black is either licorice or skunk. The brown is like chocolate or barf. So we would play, it's called Bean Boozled.
Yeah.
So we'd play the jelly bean game every couple of days. I made my dad come in one day, and he was like shooting some stuff. And so I made my dad do the jelly bean game, and it's like, it's part of the video, and it's hysterical to see him like get like boogers or something like that, and like the faces he would make, and it's just like, that's the kind of stuff that would go on. It's a beautiful book, and everybody worked so hard, and I'm so thankful, but at the same time, like, you know, I want people to have fun and be, you know, and be proud of it and enjoy coming to spend time with me or the projects, you know.
Your website is just Johnny Uzzini?
Yep, it's just johnnyuzzini.com.
Okay.
Great. Well, there'll be a listeners. There's a hot link in the description of the program on OTM Audio Archives. So click away and join in the fun. And
yep.
Johnny, thank you for injecting so much of your fun into this afternoon.
Yes.
For us. We really
appreciate
it.
When I make your puff pastry, I'll give you a special email notice.
I mean, you see, that's a great recipe to bring up, because you see how much time we did in the step-by-step, how, you know, important it was for us to really lay that out, because that's something that's a more advanced recipe, and people are afraid to make puff pastry, but we've hopefully laid it out in a way that says, okay, now I understand. Now I understand that makes sense, and that whether it's the laminating or the folding or what it does, how to fold, and so hopefully, I can't wait to hear your experience making the recipe.
Okay. Johnny, thanks again, and good talking to you again.
You as well. Have a wonderful day. Thanks, guys.
You too. Bye, Johnny.
And that's all, folks. Until the same time, same place next week, we hope you'll join us then. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.